Hello, my name is Sebastian Harlow. I am in the Fintel Library Study Room with Nathaniel Preston. It is February 22nd, 2020. And so we're just going to ask you a couple questions just to get to know you. And I think we're going to start off with your childhood. So if you just want to talk to us about that, anything, like he's kind of talking about you.
Okay. I was born in Martinsville, Virginia. The Memorial Hospital there. My mother at the time was a high school English teacher. I'm not entirely sure what my biological father did for work. I believe he worked for DuPont, but he died of cancer 6 days after I was born. So I spent a lot of time, especially when I was younger, and then definitely weekends and summers, in Mount Airy, North Carolina, with my grandparents. My mother's parents, specifically. My father's parents and that side of the family weren't super involved with me when I was younger. They hadn't particularly liked my mother, so that kind of thing bled over. Other than one uncle who used to come and spend time with me on a fairly regular basis, I was obsessed with Candyland as a child. And, you know, in that little kid way, whenever my uncle would ask, "What color is this?" showing me the card, what for his turn, and I'd tell him I thought it was just him checking to see if I knew my colors. It turns out he's colorblind. So that's one of those little things that you appreciate even more when you're older. The church was a large portion of my childhood life, as it is when you're growing up in the Bible Belt. My grandmother was on the usher board of a small AME church, African Methodist Episcopal. If you're not familiar, my grandfather did not attend church regularly. Father's Day, Christmas, and Easter were pretty much the only times he would go. He was a veteran from World War II and had been a coal miner and spent a lot of time, you know, drinking beer and watching baseball games. He's the one who taught me to, you know, hit a ball, throw a ball. I'm still a Braves fan because of him. But when you spend that much time in a church growing up, you know, all of those things kind of seep in. When I was 4, my mother met my stepfather. They met. My mom was picking me up from preschool. My dad was picking up my stepbrother, who's closest to me in age. He's only 9 months older than me, and that's where they met. They ran into each other a few times. My dad was taking a real estate course that my mother was taking as a favor to the friend who was teaching it so that there'd be enough people to actually run the class. My mom thought she was tutoring my dad. My dad had absolutely no problem with the course material. He just wanted to get to know her. And so when I was about just a few weeks before my 6th birthday, they got married. And we moved in to his home, still in the Henry County area, just the other side of the county. His 2 brothers were preachers, and his father was a preacher. All 3 Pentecostal holiness ministers. So, still, church all the time. I don't know. And I guess that's when you start to get the feeling that there are certain things you do and you don't do. And as I got older, that's when they started trying to make a good young lady out of me. This did not work. I hated dresses. I hated you know, anything that was deemed traditionally girly, except for cooking. And my dad was also an excellent cook. I learned most of what I know about cooking from him and from my grandmother. They were both the kind of people who had zero clue how to cook a small meal. It always had to be enough to feed an army, because you never know who might stop by, mm-hmm. and you had to be able to offer them something. So I still have trouble estimating how much food I need to feed people. It's terrible. And my dad, though, I remember they had made me be the flower girl in the wedding, and as soon as everything was done, I was out of the dress and into a pair of shorts and, you know, a t-shirt. But I, you know, tugged on his suit jacket, and I was like, does this mean you're my dad now? And he's like, yes, I'll be your dad now. And I always wanted to be like him growing up. He was way more extroverted than I could ever be. Never met a stranger, could walk into a building and almost talk to a brick wall. It was painful. You know, there was no such thing as a short shopping trip with him, because he'd run into, you know, everyone and have to ask, you know, how's your mom and them? You know, are you still working on that old car? That sort of thing. And if they were talking about cars, it was over. We were just stuck there. Classic cars were one of his big loves. And so I still appreciate those too. My dad, I think, always knew that I wasn't quite like my sisters, and tried to treat me mostly like my brothers. I mean, occasionally things would slip through. You know, it'd be like, hey, come help me get the riding lawnmower lifted onto the back of the truck. But then if I jumped off the back of the truck, he'd be like, quit that, you're going to skin up your legs and no man's going to want you. And I'm like, oh, I'm fine with this, it's fine. So just dumb little things. But where I grew up, everyone was kind of known by what their church affiliation was. I mean, you'd go to school and it's like, well, you know that this person went to First Baptist of Bassett, this person went to First Baptist of Stanleytown, you know, all of these things. And you kind of knew even the history of how all of these churches sprouted up, because there was a church probably every half mile through the main drags of town. It was absolutely ridiculous. Everyone wanted to ignore the hypocrisy behind a lot of it, because sometimes they happened, usually because the second, like the junior minister, ended up having an affair with the first minister's wife. And so that's when a new church would kind of spring up and things would go down. Or it's fighting about money, things like that. The church I went to youth group with, because the church that was closest to my house, mostly pretty much right across the street and one house down, they didn't really do a youth group. There was Sunday school, and you were expected to do Sunday school and vacation Bible school. But, you know, a lot of my friends were in a different youth group, and so I went with them, and it was a Southern Baptist church. And with all of the attendant issues that come out of that, you know, because the Baptists are very big on, you know, women don't get to be in positions of leadership. Drinking is definitely a no. Dancing is supposed to be a no. There's supposed to be a very definite boundaries between genders, and the way that things were done. But this church got away with a lot, mostly because the church had a lot of money. And that was kind of the trump card in interactions with the Southern Baptist Convention, because the Bassett Furniture, if you're familiar with them, which is based in the town that I'm from, you know, the man who started it and who owned it had donated this money and decided to have the church named after his daughter. So you can't really have a church named after a woman and not let women do things. But even then, in the nature of kind of the welcoming group, you know, we had a female youth minister who, you know, always told us, hey, if there's anything you need, if there's anything you need to talk about, you know, I'm here, it's going to be okay. But figuring out that you were queer, still in the evidence of all of that, wasn't really something that you could talk about. A friend of mine was outed, it was my junior year, his sophomore year. Someone that we thought we were friends with started telling everyone that he was gay. And the administration did absolutely nothing. You know, we'd have to walk in groups through the school. You know, if he needed to use the bathroom at school, you know, two people had to go with him, and most of his friends were, you know, at least outwardly female. And so we'd say, okay, so we'll wait by the door. If we hear anything start to happen, somebody's going in and the other person's going to try to get someone to stop this. You know, that was just the way things were. We were in marching band. Huge program for our school. Went to Grand Nationals every year. That's just what we did. And our rival high school was also big into marching band as well. And they had a guy in their color guard during marching band season. And the local cable access channel referred to him as a flagget on, you know, your normal news. Also a minor, you know, they're telling everybody his name and making fun of this kid who's just, you know, for all that we thought that we were grown-ups as teenagers, you know, he was a child, and yet he was, you know, this object of ridicule. So I didn't really come out to anyone until I went off to college. And even then, I didn't know everything. I figured out that I liked men and women. But I'd also gotten about as far away from home as I could before doing that. So I spent my first 3 semesters of college at the University of Pittsburgh. So, big city, you know, they filmed Queer as Folk there. You know, when you're figuring out that you're queer, it's a good place to be. And even then, I'd have to be, you know, drunk before, you know, I was willing to talk about it or even willing to kiss girls. But I did try to tell my best friend at the time, and she quit talking to me. Completely. No contact whatsoever. And I was, perhaps unsurprisingly, struggling with depression at the time. And so I'd call her and I'd leave these, you know, voicemail messages in just absolute tears. And nothing. Went home to visit, ran into her at Walmart, who's, you know, the center of small town life. And she just looked past me like she'd never met me before. And, you know, that was hard. When I was 19, I attempted suicide. if one of my roommates hadn't come home, I probably would have died. You know, they called my parents, and I managed to avoid being committed. But my parents drove from Martinsville up to Pittsburgh overnight to pick me up and bring me home. Got me into therapy, and I finally admitted to my mother, who then told my dad so I wouldn't have to, that I was bisexual. And then I got a job and started trying to put my life back together. Eventually went to, oddly enough, but it was conveniently located, Avery University, which at the time was Southern Baptist affiliated. Oops. We started a GSA on campus, and that was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back in between Averett's relationship and the Southern Baptist Convention. It was already on thin ice. There'd been a lot of other things going on, most specifically because one of my favorite professors, wonderful man, was an expert in the field of biblical archaeology, so well-known, Dr. Laughlin. But he used to start off his Old Testament class on the very first day, and he'd say, "Raise your hand if you think the Bible says homosexuality is wrong." And of course, we're at Southern Baptist College in Southwest Virginia, so hands go up. And he goes, "You're all wrong, and anyone who's told you otherwise is either ignorant or a liar." So, yeah. When the head of the religion department and the director of student affairs are your two faculty sponsors, there's not a lot that the college can do to you. But the Southern Baptists broke ties with us over all that. And I thought that I was going to, you know, go into education and do that sort of thing. That didn't work out for me. So eventually I ended up moving to Roanoke. So that was probably 2007. And I've been here ever since. Mostly working retail and food. I got my master's degree in business in Averett's program based in Roanoke. But as I was figuring all of that out and, you know, settling into queer life, I started realizing that I couldn't keep ignoring my gender identity, which then of course makes things super interesting when you're trying to apply for positions, because, you know, you've got student loans to pay off, and you've got bills to pay, you got to make rent and all these things, and you're trying to get a job in a field that none of your work experience is in, and then you're gender nonconforming, and it's rough. You know, I had an MBA. My track record in jobs was great, but I showed up for an interview with a clothing store. I won't name them because, you know, other people's experience may not be the experience that I had with them, but I'm in, you know, a vest, a button-down, and a tie. You know, I look good. But, and I introduce myself, and I just see the look on the interviewer's face. The what on earth have I gotten into kind of look. Obviously, I ended up not getting that job, even though my resume was impressive and she admitted it. It's still that, I don't think that this is going to work for the business that we're in. Alright. Sure. Yeah. Years pass. I get another job closer to home. It's for a while I was commuting from Roanoke to Christiansburg every day. And, you know, at this point I've had therapy. I'm finally out as you know, a trans man. I've started HRT. I've gotten my legal name change. I go in for an interview, panel interview. Everyone's super impressed with me. They offer me the job. I have to go through the background check. And there's no option to give them any other previous names. But then, of course, you know, the social matches and they find this. And then I get a call and it's like, we've decided to go in a different direction. Great. And this is after they've asked me to put in my notice at my other job. And so it's like, suddenly, instead of making more money than, you know, I've ever made in my life, I don't have a job. Luckily, I find something pretty quickly. It's a pay cut, but the schedule's better than what I've been working before. And it's really nice for once to work with a group of people who've only ever known me as Nathaniel. It's a really nice change. And, you know, eventually I get a job working in my field, just, you know, 8 years longer than I expected it was going to take, but, you know, at least I'm working for a company now that, you know, offers transgender-related healthcare and its insurance and has a transition policy and all these things. I know I'm one of the lucky ones. There are a lot of people I know that aren't so lucky.
So you kind of told us about some of the trans issues and the obstacles you face. Do you foresee some of those changing over the years? Do you think that, like, especially in Roanoke?
Roanoke has always been an interesting city. When I was growing up, you know, as the queer kids were finding each other and people were leaving, it was pretty much they either moved north to Roanoke or south to Greensboro. You know, both places that had, you know, gay bars and gay clubs, and it was a little bit easier to blend in, but then you weren't too far away from home, so you could still go back if you needed to. I didn't intend to stay in Roanoke, necessarily. It just kind of happened. My, I guess, soon-to-be ex-wife, you know, her family was in Franklin County, and so, yeah, we talked about moving, but, you know, our nephews and niece were born, and she didn't want to be that far away from them when they were growing up. We got involved with Roanoke Pride, and we're both on the board of that for several years. I ran the festival. And Roanoke is technically the longest continually running Pride Festival in the state of Virginia, which surprises a lot of people to know. Because they're all like, you'd think, like, Hampton Roads or Richmond would have gotten there first. And I think they all started at similar times, but Richmond's Pride fell off for a while. Same thing out in Hampton Roads.
So what kind of activities do you partake in during Roanoke Pride over the years?
There's always been the festival. When it started back in the 80s, it was really just kind of a potluck picnic. And then it grew and it, you know, moved around. It's been in Wasena Park, it's been in Highland Park, it's been in Elmwood. We had the 1 year that it was in, I'm losing the name of it, River's Edge Park. So there's always been kind of an element of just coming out and hanging out. You know, food vendors, drag shows. I mean, Roanoke used to have a huge and vibrant drag history. And that is, it waned, and now I think it's kind of growing again. You know, now there are multiple drag brunches and things. At one point, there were 6 different pageants that were going on, you know, so it's not a big enough city for 6 national title holders. And so I mean, those were some of the things that we did, kind of at the peak. The Redneck Diversity Center, when it got started, would do their film festival. And, you know, we'd have some kickoff parties leading up into the festival itself. We've done parades, but they're kind of a nightmare in terms of Red Oak City and just dealing with the city and getting the permits, because you have to try to keep it close enough to the park where the festival is happening, which is unfortunately right on top of multiple major thoroughfares in the city. So getting the permissions to shut that off, and then the cost involved in having off-duty police officers man the parade route, it makes it difficult. We did, it's the last 2 years that I was involved with the festival, we developed a relationship with the city, and kind of as an in-kind sponsor, you know, they waived the fee for renting the park, and helped provide some of the security coverage that we needed, because there are always protesters. And, you know, in as much as most conservatives are like, you know, it's nobody's business. Well, if it's not your business, why do you care? But the reason we kind of kept doing it, and, you know, while we still go, even though I'm not doing it anymore, it's the remembering the first Pride that I went to, and it's like, hey, there are a few thousand people here who are like me, especially in Southwest Virginia. When you're worried that it's like you and a handful of friends, that's the importance of Pride, you know, even now where, you know, we have just the park. The back street doesn't really exist as it was any longer, and it wasn't really a gay bar for years before it was finally bought out. And the same thing's happening in cities across the country. I mean, even the Village isn't as gay as it used to be. You know, as we gain kind of mainstream acceptance in some ways, we lose the core of community that kind of was the hallmark of the queer community for so long.
Do you think there's a way for us to come back to those places?
I think that we'd have to stop trying to assimilate so much. It's like, even as corporate sponsors enable you to like make your Pride festivals bigger and better and reach more people and have even bigger name entertainers, there's also an element of selling out involved in that. And so where, you know, we come from at Stonewall, you know, to the we're just like you. We want the exact same things. Like heteronormative, monogamous, like assimilation is hurting so much. You know, black culture, queer culture, and the intersection of the two was responsible for so much of, like, fashion, music, dance, all sorts of things, and we lose that, and it's kind of sad. And even, you know, just, I'm a, you know, transgender, pansexual, polyamorous person. But even then, you know, we also live a fairly normal life. You know, my current partner and her and my metamor, like, we live together, we're raising teenagers. It's like, at the same time, yes, we do all still want the same kinds of things. Some of us do, but we're not a monolith. You know, I know people who absolutely don't ever want children, and they're still, you know, humans. As a culture, we like putting people in these little boxes, and it's not that easy.
So you said you're raising a teenager.
Yes, we have two teenagers. My nesting partner, and her husband, I met him more, and then her previous husband, they had one son who's 26, and so everyone's like, wait, you're how old and you have a 26-year-old? And I'm like, well, one, my wife's older than me, and, you know, my contribution to his parenting at this point is, you know, trying to remind him that work will always be there, life might not be. And that's coming from experience, and then also trying to get him to quit drinking shitty beer. then, you know, our two younger kids, our daughter's a senior. She's trying to figure out where she wants to go to college. She's active in the high school's Gay Straight Alliance. And, you know, she's got trans and gender non-conforming friends, and, you know, she always tries to make sure to introduce her parents to their parents and make sure that we meet the friends who might need help the most. And then our youngest is 15. He's a sophomore. And they're a joy. Empathetic, and they have a strong sense of right and wrong, and watching them form their own opinions on politics and things is fun, because, you know, politics in this country is a giant dumpster fire right now, and seeing them and knowing that they understand that, hey, this isn't the way things are supposed to be, and, you know, writing opinion papers with zero prompting from us, that I know this is what's right, and go with it. So I think the kids are all right. I have hope.
That's good. So what was it like? So you're raising teenagers in Roanoke. Do you think it would have been different had you raised them in Martinsville with the childhood area that you were in?
God, no. I would never raise children. I don't know, people that I went to high school with who are raising children there, and they're having to fight some of the same battles that we had to fight when we were kids there. You know, it's still a profoundly not diverse place. I mean, things have improved. They had a gay homecoming king a few years ago. Like, and that never would have happened when we were in high school. When I was in high school, the newspaper ran editorials talking about stripping the homecoming queen of her title because she had a tongue piercing. Really? So to have an openly gay homecoming king, alright, we've made some progress. It's still, you know, having out gay teachers is still not really a thing. Like, it's always the kind of open secret, like, people know, but, you know, you don't really talk about it. I mean, because it's still that same sort of stigma. My mother raised my younger cousin, who's, you know, now 19, and she's a student at Tech. But when she was little in the elementary, like in the after school program there, one of the directors for the program was a lesbian, and people kept talking about whether or not she was able, like, capable of doing that job. It's like, you know, it's not contagious. But yeah, this is the same place where you know, it comes out that the sheriff's department has been confiscating drugs and then selling them themselves or using them. Whole big thing. And then, you know, the next sheriff election comes around, the incumbent sheriff steps down, someone who's not from there runs against, you know, the previous sheriff's right-hand man, and you'd think, obvious police corruption. But who wins the election? The corruption they're comfortable with, not the outsider. It's just, it's always going to be that kind of place. And granted, it had a huge manufacturing background. Like, that's what it was. Mm-hmm. Furniture manufacturing, yeah. You had three. You had Bassett, you had Stanley, and you had Hooker Furniture. And then you had Sara Lee Knit Products. Mm-hmm. DuPont was there. All of these things. And then NAFTA happened. And the jobs left. And, you know, a lot of people left with it, but then a lot of other people stayed. And the ones who stayed are the ones who, like, changed the least. So change happens slowly, but, you know, as people, and I hate to say it, die off, it might get better. I mean, some more jobs are moving in down there. They did actually hold a Pride Festival there last year for the very first time. Someone had started talking about it probably 8 years ago, and it took that long for it to actually happen. There have been drag shows at the Dutch Inn, which is like the big hotel in town that also had a bar, and so that's where people used to go. And so, hey, they were doing drag shows like twice a month on Sundays, and you know, it was the talk of the town, how scandalous it was. So no, I would not want to raise children there for a variety of reasons. You know, there's just not enough for them to do. Cultural opportunities are few and far between. Like right now, our kids don't drive. They're not really interested in it, but it's not a huge thing to get them to where they want to go either. You know, down there, my parents made me get my license. They're like, no, we can't just keep driving you everywhere. And I mean, and in their defense, it was kind of true. I resented it at the time because one of my close friends had died in a car accident, and I was with her and another friend of ours when it happened. And so, you know, consequently, understandably, like, not at all interested in getting behind the wheel of a car. And, you know, tough love. And it's a good thing that they made me, because otherwise I might never have learned, and I really needed to. But, you know, we can afford to let them do things on their own time. And even then, you know, almost one of us is almost always home, you know, to make them dinner and things like that. And, you know, my parents, my mom worked, and depending on, you know, she moved from being a teacher to being an administrator. And as she's working, you know, sometimes she was out of school, you know, as much as an hour away, and then having to make that commute. And then my dad did a lot of volunteer work. He'd had to take a disability retirement from DuPont. But he was, you know, really active with the Freemasons and with the Shriners and doing all those things. So he had meetings. So, you know, I had to learn to do things like cook and things because, you know, it's like nobody's delivering pizza out in the sticks.
So I do have a question about when you were talking about, like, the lack of change that people were susceptible to in Martinsville. Do you think that's different here in Roanoke?
I think Roanoke has a more diverse population in a lot of ways. I mean, local colors is kind of an example of that. When I was growing up, you know, you had black kids, you had white kids, you had a few, and this is going to sound terrible when I say it, but that's just, it was the mentality. Mexican kids, whether they were from Mexico or Central America or anything else, they were Mexicans as far as everyone was concerned. Like, the Asian population of our high school was a kid who was a quarter Korean. Like, you weren't running into different ideas. Yeah, you know, everyone, almost everyone was going to a Baptist church. We had, like, three Catholic kids. We had no Jewish population. You know, it was, everyone was pretty much the same. Roanoke has the benefit of having a lot more cultures bumping into each other. And there's still, you know, very strong religious sentiment here. But there's also more business. So, you know, the airport helps. Now that we've got Amtrak, you know, there's more travel in and out of the city. You know, these businesses are doing business with people around the world, and it's harder to stand against change when you're encountering new things all the time.
I actually really like that you mentioned that, because I kind of want to talk to you about the park and kind of the influx and the change that it's kind of undergone, from, it's primarily known as the gay club, but there's so much more there now.
Yes.
And I kind of wanted to ask what your experience was with the park, like your first experience or kind of your favorite one.
I guess because I was kind of young, I was still 17 when I graduated from high school. So I didn't really get to experience the park until I guess I'd come home for, it's probably Christmas break, my freshman year of college, and an old friend of mine from our rival high school, but we'd gotten along really well ever since we first met, because we were, you know, black queer kids, and of course, not everyone knew that, and so everyone was like, you guys are such a cute couple. No. No, we're really not, but sure. But he and I came up to Roanoke, and we went to the park on New Year's Eve. And, you know, came home, and we ended up back in Roanoke the very next day with a friend of ours, because the mall in Martinsville, such as it is, was awful even then, and now it's only gotten worse. So we came up to Roanoke to shop with a friend of ours who, you know, the three of us had always spent a lot of time together, but, you know, he was home. He had just finished basic training. And so we're like, all right, we're all going to hang out. And we're trying really hard to figure out, you know, how to tell him that we're queer. Because we hadn't told him. We're like, all right, we're going to do it. We're going to tell him now's the time. And, you know, we're putting it off all day. And at one point, he looks at my friend Orlando, and he's like, dude, is that glitter on your face? And we're like, oh, don't know where that came from. Trying to play it off like we hadn't, you know, been covered in body glitter the night before. And so we had to, like, sit him down in the cafe at the Barnes & Noble at Tanglewood and, you know, come out to him. So that's kind of the most memorable thing. It wasn't really... the night at the park was whatever, you know. That was back before they had a liquor license. So it was just beer and, like, wine coolers. But still, the chance to, you know, wear glitter and drink, even though we really weren't supposed to be, and smoke cigarettes and just, you know, be around mostly gay people. Yeah. That was great. I mean, and even then, coming to the park, after I'd moved to Roanoke and, you know, had friends, like, we'd go, and then there were always random straight guys there, You know, straight women are like, yes, I want to go dance with the gay guys, and it's fine. And then you have the guys who are trying to date these women who are like, why am I here? Obviously uncomfortable, and then trying to dance with women and not realizing that, hey, most of the women here have zero interest in you. You know, it's, the bar scene has never really been my scene, but it was still really important for us to have that opportunity. And over the years, things have changed. You know, now they've got a liquor license and they serve more food and things, but still going to the park on Pride weekend is, it's like old home week. You see all of these people that, you know, you might not have seen in years. You know, people who are in town just to go to Pride again. And, you know, it's still, in a lot of ways, home for the Roanoke gay community. I mean, the Roanoke Diversity Center does a lot of great work. And it's particularly great for people who can't be around, like, alcohol and consumption and things like that. And for those who are past the point of loud music being what they want to do. And so I'm glad that the RDC got off the ground when it did, because it is a great resource for information and for community outside of the bars. I think we are losing some of history in, you know, especially the bars where the gathering places are, especially like at the height of the AIDS crisis. You know, there'd be the people who would be there, and then suddenly they weren't there anymore. And that was kind of, you know, your marking time. And that is sad. It's, it's even like in the Black community, like your sororities and your fraternities, you know, the Divine Nine are like the staples of the Black college experience, but even they are losing numbers. So it's one of those, like, as times change and everyone becomes more integrated, you lose something important historically. Or, you know, it's still there, but it's different, and people don't understand why you're sad about it being gone. And it's like, well, it's great now. We can go to whatever club or bar we want to go to. Well, yes, we can, but it's still not the same. You know, the idea that after Obama, that we're in like a post-racist country. It's like, no, it's not quite. But people can't see past the, well, we had a Black president. And they're like, well, if Buttigieg gets elected, then we'll have a gay president and it'll fix things. It's like, it's not going to fix things. And, you know, he is, you know, for whatever, however we feel about his policy positions, he's still, like, the most comfortable version of gay that a lot of people are ever going to be. Like, they're like, okay, he's a Christian white guy, he's married, you know, he was a military vet. It's like, this is the most palatable gay. And that leaves behind all of us who are not palatable gay.
Do you think that's a step forward or a step backward for getting people to change and kind of expand on the idea beyond kind of, I guess, I would almost say stereotypical, or kind of like a formula or a mold?
In some ways, I would say representation like that it moves us like baby steps forward. My mother has always loved me, but has had trouble kind of assimilating my identity first as bisexual and, you know, now as a trans man. But Modern Family helped her kind of get there with dealing with, okay, my kid is queer and married. All right, I can work with this. Laverne Cox, bless her soul, in Orange is the New Black, helped my mom recognize, okay, the transgender community is a thing. Yeah, and it helps, and we can't discount the help, but it's still not getting us completely there. And in some ways, it's not always helpful. You know, the idea, the wrong body narrative that gets people kind of to understand the trans identity in some ways, it's super uncomfortable. And so for some people, yes, it's their truth, but it's not everyone's truth. And it's really unhelpful for non-binary or, you know, agender, gender fluid folks. Really, really not helpful for them. But you have to weigh the good that it's doing versus the harm that it's going to come. You know, there are people who really felt like we should have dropped the trans identity from getting employment protections passed back in the late 90s, early 2000s. Like, well, if we drop the T, we can get there and we can get, you know. And then once we're there, we can add that back in and try to move the line a little further. But when you do things like that, all you do is put your more marginalized or more vulnerable people further behind.
Yeah. I know you mentioned the Roanoke Diversity Center a little bit ago, and kind of the separation from the bar scene. Do you think that there could be some sort of program or, like, outreach at the Diversity Center that could help in Roanoke with kind of, like, the issues you were talking about of having employment issues and representation? Do you think there could be, like, either, like, I don't know, a push or something?
They've done some things like that historically. They had their own speakers bureau for a while that would go and kind of talk to businesses, talk to school systems and things like that. And I pinch-hitted for them a few times when they were looking for more people of color who were part of the queer community. But because they are a very small nonprofit, a lot of their money comes from grants or comes from donations or fundraisers they can do, and they're kind of spread a little thin. You know, and they do host support groups and things like that in their center, and they try to do some outreach through some of their grant money, but it's hard for them to get funding. And right now I'm part of Equality Virginia's Transgender Advocacy Speakers Bureau. And because EV is a statewide organization and they get some of that sweet, sweet Northern Virginia money, that kind of helps them have a little bit more reach. And I wish, you know, that some of that could come into Roanoke so that we could get a little further. But they are trying to at least talk to the marginalized groups more, making sure that, you know, HIV-positive people have support that they need, you know, and they work with the Council for Community Services on that, making sure that the multiple transgender umbrella support groups have a place. My wife runs a bisexual, pansexual, like, all middle sexuality support group there. You know, they're doing good work. They sponsor at least one of the local, like, drag bingos and try to do things out in the community like that, to try to raise awareness of the issues. But in Roanoke, a lot of the issues come down to unemployment and underemployment, housing protections, you know, things like that. And so they spend a lot of time trying to talk to our local legislators about things like that. So they're encouraged to, you know, help pass those things. In this area, there's a lot of conservatives that sort of not getting there. Bless Sam Rizzold being from, you know, the city, because he's kind of our progressive voice, and Senator Edwards. So we don't have a lot of that from out here. But I think if we can finish getting the Virginia Values Act passed, that's going to do a lot for people around here. Because the governor says he'll sign it, and then we'll be the first state in the South with housing and employment protections for LGBT folks. And, you know, back in 2006 when they passed, you know, the constitutional amendment for the state constitution to outlaw gay marriage, I didn't think we'd ever get here. Mm-hmm. There's hope.
Yeah. Do you think if we got backing from, like, the city of Roanoke, that would help a lot? Or do you think it would still kind of keep us where we're at?
I think it would help. I know that, I mean, and Joe Cobb, being vice mayor, is helping. You know, he's a prominent voice. He's well-known and well-liked in pretty much every circle. I think some funding for that would be great. But then, you know, there's also the, we've got a lot of problems in the city in terms of economics, and in some ways, if we're making sure that, you know, all of our under-income folks can eat and have housing, that's going to help the LGBT community too. You know, several of the city's schools have, like, free breakfast and lunch for all of their students because we're not able to take care of, you know, children. But I think passing more progressive policies will help bring in more jobs. Mm-hmm. As the statement always says, equality means business. The company I work for, that's one of the things, you know, it's making sure to be involved and to have policies, and, you know, they did the Corporate Equality Index survey for the first time last year, and, you know, got a 90, which in terms of the auto parts business is pretty much as good as you're going to get, because the other 10% come from things like your supply chain, and there's just not a lot of queer people making auto parts yet. You know, hopefully we'll get there.
Rainbow cars.
That chameleon car paint was super popular for a while in the 90s. It could make a comeback.
So I guess just a couple more questions, because I don't want to take up too much of your time. A little bit, you did talk about the bar scene wasn't really your scene. What would you call your scene?
I like the coffee shop bookstore kind of thing. I don't like loud noises. Other than, like, concerts where you're completely surrounded by, like, uniform sound. I think it's an anxiety thing. I don't like being in loud places where I can't always see who's, like, around me. And we don't really have a gay bookstore. I wish we did. That's always been, like, side dream. Hey,
I thought it was the Tanglewood Barnes & Noble.
I mean, the Tanglewood Barnes & Noble used to be even more gay. when I worked there many years ago, about a third of the staff was queer of some variety. And that's when, back when we had, like, almost 60 employees working in that store, so it was a lot. and for a while, I was maintaining the LGBT section, like, shortlisting books in and, you know, making sure that, you know, we had the stuff that people were looking for. But then, in the grand tradition of corporate retail, they're like, well, we're going to cut staffing because that will save us money, as opposed to, you know, having people there to make sure that everything is where it's supposed to be and that you can have the looks that people are looking for. You know, even a decent portion of the management staff there at the time was queer. And so, yes, we did. That used to be it. But, you know, I've spent some time in cities like Philadelphia, or even if you're in Richmond, like Denver City Thrift. You know, so you have the community center, you have a shop, there's like a little cafe where people can spend time. Even in daylight hours, you know, there's a place to gather that doesn't necessarily revolve around alcohol and is therefore more accessible for the youth, too. Because I would have given a lot of money as a queer kid to see a queer adult that wasn't having to hide who they were. And, you know, now, bless the internet, you know, there's an idea that, you know, yes, you know, Neil Patrick Harris with his husband and his adorable children are living the dream. We're still getting there with kind of like our trans role models. But there's still community there. But there's a lot to be said for, you know, getting together and going into a space where there are stories like you, easily accessible. You don't have to order them. You know, your magazines are there and the covers, you know, easily visible, unlike, you know, Curve and, you know, The Advocate and Out that used to come in the, like, black poly mailers. And now, at least, The Advocate comes in a clear mailer. But, you know, you couldn't even voluntarily opt out of the packaging at one point. It was always, it has to come in the opaque mailer, so no one knows what you're getting. This sense of shame. So, it would be nice if we had something like that. And having the library is nice now. But, you know, it could also use some more donations. So it's not the same, you know, dozen lesbian mysteries and things like that. Copies of the Gay Kama Sutra, you know, 3 copies of it, and the band played on, that sort of thing. Because there's more out there. And there's even more out there for, like, for young adults, even like middle grade readers. I loved the Benicula books when I was growing up, you know, the vampire bunny who would suck your vegetables dry. But it wasn't until I was an adult that I found out that, you know, James Howell, who had written those books that I loved so much, was gay. And then he wrote some books that have, you know, a gay middle school protagonist who, you know, whose best friend is running for, like, student council. And, you know, hey, these are kids just like us who are going through their lives. You know, David Levithan is there. And, you know, his books are somewhat fantastical because these kids are queer and they're living in, like, small towns in middle America, but it's an absolute non-issue. You're like, this is utopia, and it's absolutely unrealistic, but I love it because it gives me this chance to turn my brain off and just be like, hey, there's someone in this story who's like me. As opposed to the, you know, dead lesbian trope. It's like, yes, you can show these women having a relationship together, but one of them has to die and or go evil. You know, that's the way things used to be. You know, it's like you saw Willow and Tara have, you know, their heartfelt reunion, and then the morning after they reconcile, oh, Tara's dead now. It's like, why? Even the movies used to do the same sorts of things. It's like, hey, you can show this, but here's the caveat.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I actually really enjoyed this. It was really nice meeting you and hearing about Martinsville, because I don't really get to hear a whole lot about that. So this is Sebastian Harlow signing off.